Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for December 21st, 2014. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone. Greetings from Atlanta.
Yes. And join us just any minute. He's already emailed back in trying to get some of the coordination of the facts. Charlie Harper is going to be our guest. He's the head writer, head blogger at Peach Pundit, been on multiple times, just one of our best guests. I would dare say, Catherine, our best guest from the other side of the aisle that we've had on, and he's been on multiple times, and been a while since he's been on, but he agreed to be on tonight, and so excited about him calling in a minute, and I'm going to try to pull away and try to coordinate that if I need to. But, of course, Catherine, anything you can do to help if you're getting these same emails, help me out. We'll take care of that thing. We don't have a producer.
I haven't seen anything from him.
Well, I guess what? I see him on the board, which is even better.
There he is.
Hear all that rest. Charlie, we already introduced you without you being on the air, but now you are. Welcome back, Charlie Harper.
Well, it's good to be here. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, good.
Hey, Charlie, yeah. How you doing?
Hello, Catherine.
Yeah, well, let's start off. Charlie, we have just hashed it out for the last few Kudzu Vines since election 2014 about what we think, and we've had some Democrats' perspectives. We've had some, I guess, neutral observers in the case of David Martin, but we haven't had a GOP observer tell us his or her thoughts on what happened in the election. Just kind of give us your synopsis and kind of put maybe a little bit of a southern slant on it if you feel that's pertinent.
I tend to focus pretty close to Georgia and Georgia only, but at the same point, it's hard to say this isn't a national wave election to start off with. At the end of the day, the president just wasn't able to convince, I think, a wide range of voters that his policies were really the right direction, and he did ultimately, I mean, from what I remember, if I've got the chronology right, the Sunday and Monday before the November election on Tuesday, Air Force One was pretty much grounded. Where the president did decide to go in, it was pretty much for governor's races in what were perceived to be safe states. So then the president didn't really get terribly involved almost anywhere, specifically on camera, stayed way away from the Senate races. But what he did is he called in, such as here in Georgia, he called in the V103, which is the largest African-American market radio station in the state, and pretty much said the line that Democrats were already running away from, which is my policies are on the ballot. And when you look at specifically David Perdue's poll numbers, that was almost the same day that Perdue, who looked like he was in trouble, started to move in internal polls. And frankly, I didn't put that together at the time. It was a friend of mine that pointed that out to me later. But a week out, 2 weeks out, there were still a lot of high-ranking GOP folks that were very concerned about David Perdue being in a runoff in Georgia. I think most of us still thought he would be able to win a runoff. Most of us at that point thought that the governor, we already saw kind of his polls, and that the governor's polls were pretty strong. But if there was a place that Democrats looked like they really had possibly gained a potential toehold, it was in the U.S. Senate race. And by the time it was done, I believe Perdue actually got a couple thousand votes more than Governor Deal. And, you know, that was the one race that the president tails on, it looked like, in Georgia. So at the end of the day, Georgia really kind of for the first time in a long, long time, if not ever, really kind of became a national battleground state. The amount of money that was spent in Georgia on both sides from outside groups really almost dwarfed a lot of the efforts that happened locally for both parties. And at the end of the day, it didn't change anything. the governor won, I think, within 0.2 of a point of the same margin that he won 4 years ago. And, you know, Republicans still pretty much have everything statewide. And if I'm remembering right, we pretty much held every state Senate, every state House seat in Georgia. So really, despite the fact this was going to be the year that changed everything for Democrats, nothing really changed.
Yeah, I think as far as changes, the biggest race was on John Barrow's congressional seat. Progress thing for Democrats is it seemed like a race most of the time in the top two races, whereas unless you were just a really, really optimistic person, 2010 didn't seem that way in the governor's race. So that might be something to look at, although I guess some people say final score trumps all. Well, we see, like you said, there wasn't a lot of progress made. If you were each side, and this is really a two-parter, and then I'm going to pass it to Catherine for some questions. If you were the Republicans, how would you try to lock this thing down, knowing that we'll talk about demographics, and, you know, you could say that is not as big a factor as people think. Or if you're Democrats, how do you create the opening that's not in September and October, but actually lasts till Election Day when the votes are really
Well, I think you've got two things going here. You've got Republicans that, just to be blunt, had gotten fat, dumb, happy, and arrogant in a lot of ways of thinking things were always going to be this way. And the polls showing that this was competitive shook a lot of folks up. And as a Republican, I'll say that it shook them up in a good way. It got them to look seriously at not only where we are now, but where we're going to be in the future. And they responded accordingly. I openly questioned and publicly questioned back about the time the runoffs were set, whether or not we in Georgia as Republicans even knew how to run a general election anymore, because we have geared our politics so much over the past to running primaries that I wasn't even sure we left our message open to where we were going to be competitive in a general, and or that we knew just frankly how to do the campaign tactics that are required to run a general election and to get voters to a poll and to move independent voters to our column rather than primary, which is just, you know, how you divide folks that think generally alike, and the messages and the things you campaign on are very different. And I think Republicans rose to that challenge. And more importantly, I have not heard the folks that matter, the folks that actually will be helping shape policy and giving us a record to govern for the next 4 years here at the state level. They don't seem to be backing away from what they think they learned. And so I think you're going to see a much more proactive governing Republican majority over the next couple of years to 4 years, because I think they know that they've got to have a record that when folks say what is Republican majority meant to Georgia, they're going to have to be able to point something. And shifting over to where you said what it means for Democrats and the changing demographics, the first answer to that question isn't one that would normally and obviously be a Republican thing that you would say, but Nathan Deal's legacy so far is criminal justice reform. He's brought something three of his years as a major package. The first year he was in, he did HOPE reform. But since then, every year, he's had a signature thing on how to reform part of the criminal justice system, including sentencing reform, juvenile justice reform, overall a decriminalization package that moved a lot of things that were felonies to misdemeanors and lowered the level for misdemeanors, just frankly to get people out of our prison system, especially for things that didn't need to be there. And as far as why that matters for changing demographics, the benefit of that, in addition to it being a tangible budget savings for the state, what it meant is a 20% reduction in new incarcerations for African-American males. And when you can go on to places Republicans aren't known for campaigning and say things like that and make it tangible and real, it's really hard for Democrats to continue to paint Republicans as just the party of white men. And so you saw last week here in Georgia, Dean Bucci was appointed as a Superior Court judge in Paulding County, for the Paulding County Circuit, rather. And it was not in the headline in the press release that was sent out, but Judge Bucci is the first person, first Hispanic American to serve a Superior Court in the state of Georgia. I mean, Republicans are starting to do the things, and more importantly, to let people know they're doing the things, that it's really, frankly, a much more inclusive party. And so while the demographics of the state are very clearly changing, there are a lot of Republicans, that, including myself, that will not cede that as a reason to believe that a Democratic takeover is inevitable. And frankly, if you see kind of who's going the wrong way in demographics right now, and you look at how the exit poll showed, it's the Democrats are really kind of having more problem with keeping a coalition together, because they, you know, didn't even, they lost a little bit of ground among African Americans. They lost a huge amount of ground on white Americans, and they didn't pick anything up. In fact, I think they lost ground on Hispanics that voted in the high 40-something percent for Republicans. And so Republicans are going to have a message and be, continue to be consistent, but their message has to be clear that it is for all of Georgians. And if they do that, we're not talking about a four more years of a majority. We're talking about a really long time. And it, when and if the majority switch, it's not going to be because of demographics.
Yeah, it's kind of vexing. A white person is a campaign manager for a white candidate, and they can't figure out how to get white people to vote for them. And that's, unfortunately, in the South, a lot of Democrats are really stuck on that riddle, which is kind of ironic, crazy, whatever you want to say. Well, Catherine, what are some questions you have on just general direction of Georgia and the South for Charlie? Let me check Catherine's
Maybe we've answered all of her questions.
Oh, no, I'm here. I'm here. I'm sorry. I had to unmute because I have this terrible cough. I just wanted to say one thing about, I'd like maybe further this discussion about demographics, because I have been saying for a long time that nobody can just count on demographics. I mean, you've got to stand up for something, you know, whether it's whatever it is, so that so that you can attract those demographics that you think should be attracted to you as a party. So I hope that Democrats recognize that, and I hope they're not just going to rest on their laurels and say, oh, well, the African Americans are going to vote for us, and the Latinos are going to vote for us, and the population of those two groups is increasing, so we're going to be okay. I don't think the Democrats are doing that. I think they're, you know, trying to build coalitions and stand up for the things that they think will attract those demographics, which are the values that the Democrats have always stood up for. As far as the criminal justice reforms that Governor Deal has done, I think they're great, but I think that they certainly help the African American community, but I think it's a little, I'm not so sure that they're going to attract African American vote. I think they're changes that have been needed for a long time, and I think it's more like, oh, well, finally we're getting to the point where we should be. Let's not assume that that means that the Republicans are opening their hearts and minds to the African American community. I think that's a little bit much, but as far
I'll
as questions,
I'll just take what you just said and at least look in there and find the compliment that you at least admit Republicans have a heart, even if it's not open.
I mean, I'm glad that he did it, and I'm sure that there's some. I think that generally, as the governor and, you know, someone who's, you know, primary, not primary responsibility, but big responsibility is budget. These things were very important for the budget. It'll be interesting to see how these private prison and parole systems respond to all these changes and how that's going to pan out. It looks like that could be a little problem, not for the governor, but for these, you know, companies. There seems to be some problems around that. But I don't think we need to – that's not our worry. That's their worry. As far as the rest of the South, do you think that this was – so – okay, let me expand on this a little bit. I think that part of the problem was that Democrats didn't embrace the president as we should have. And so some of us diehard Democrats were like, yeah, you know, I'm going to vote for my people, but I might not work as hard as I would because, you know, there's a lot of us who like the president and think that he's done a lot of really good things in the time that he's been there. And I think that some of the people who steered clear of the president, I think that hurt them with the base. So I'm not so sure that I don't think that it wasn't that he didn't want to help Democrats. I think they didn't want help from him. And I think that was a mistake.
I will not presume to tell Democrats what they need to do specifically, nor pretend that y'all know what, or that I know better what's going on internally with your party. But I'll make a general observation that generally whenever a party loses badly in an election, the party base tends to believe it's because we weren't pure enough. And trust me, I hear it on our side all the time. You know, if we had just nominated, you know, Paul Brown, if we had just nominated, you know, Rick Santorum for president last time instead of Romney, everything would have been our way. So I say that to say I don't know how embracing the president fully would have gotten you a better result. I just don't. The president's poll numbers, approval rating going into November were just horrible, especially when you start looking at what your average Georgian votes on. We are still, and always frankly have been, a relatively conservative state.
Right.
That's not to say it will be always. When you start looking at demographic changes, the thing that, you know, when demographic, let's be blunt, demographic changes is a code word for saying Georgia is going to be less white, therefore Democrats will win. What you probably need to be looking at isn't so much demographic changes as population changes. Because Georgia's going to add, over the next 25 years, roughly, 4 million people. And those 4 million that come here, mostly seeking opportunity of some sort, may not be a lot like the last 4 million people that moved here that tended to be relatively conservative, even if not Southern conservative, traditional Bible Belt conservative, social conservatives. But they were at least generally coming here in the 70s and 80s out of areas where there was not economic opportunity, and there was economic opportunity here, and a Republican message probably spoke to them. As it goes forward and these next 4 million come in, I'm not sure that the party labels matter as much to people that are coming here for opportunity, and I'm speaking in one industry in particular, and that's the film industry. Georgia's made a very conscious decision to keep something called a film tax credit, where the folks that do production of movie, film, TV get a very large part of what they spend back to lure those industries here. And we all know about, you know, Kasim Reed is negotiating with Tyler Perry, I think, to put the final dot I's cross T's on Fort Mac, becoming a major studio just down the road from where I grew up in Fayette County on a very distant relative's farm. Is several thousand acres that are now going to be Pinewood Studios, which is, I believe,
right,
the James Bond studio, but it's a very major production just down the road from that is where The Walking Dead's been filmed forever. There's another outfit going in, I-85 at Jimmy Carter Boulevard, just north of the Spaghetti Junction interchange in Atlanta. That's going to be one of the largest indoor
Lakewood
sound stages ever. There is a proposed deal for Lakewood. There's one at Covington. They go on and on. I mean, honestly, I have literally lost count of how many studios we have investing here. It's not that we're going to be Hollywood. We pretty much are Hollywood already when these studios get built. We're going to have as much production capability here as you pretty much have in Southern California and New York. We'll at least be a co-equal of those two if we don't outright pass them. The governor is investing heavily in our new, the HOPE. We have a technical college scholarship, basically, and we've added a lot of film set design and other production type technologies that are needed for workforce development to train the people to have these jobs. These are the folks that are going to be here. And let's be blunt, the people in that industry are not really known for rabid conservatism. So if we add a couple hundred thousand jobs in that industry over the next 10 years, that's probably going to be a net plus for Democrats. I have no idea what racial component they will be, but they're probably not going to be as rapidly conservative as me and the people that vote like me. So you have some opportunity there going forward. But at the same point, I don't know that even the Republican Party 10 years to 15 years from now is going to be the same Republican Party that you're dealing with, because we have our own factional struggles internally. And you know, the libertarian-leaning Republicans are a huge and growing force, and, that's a different push that and struggle for Republicans to figure out how to let their message evolve to accommodate that in a big tent and not still peacefully coexist with social conservatives and defense conservatives and the many other brands that we have. And so there's going to be a lot of changes over time, but at the end of the day, we've got, you know, we do this 2 years at a time for the most part. And for the next 2 years, I don't really see demographics being an issue. And, you know, it will be a presidential election year, so y'all clearly are going to be living or dying by the success of whoever it is on your ticket, as Republicans will likely, you know, do that as well. We at least have the benefit of our main statewide race this year being Johnny Isakson. He's generally popular, definitely among independents and middle-of-the-road types, in addition to I think he'll have no problem whatsoever in a Republican primary if there is one. He probably will get token opposition because that's just the way things work these days. But I just really don't see the opportunity for a pickup in the U.S. Senate here, and I would be it really, you know, 2 years out, it's hard to tell depending on who gets nominated, but I just don't see Georgia being a blue state when we're lighting things up in November of 2016 as to how Georgia voted for president.
Catherine, I'll tell you what. Go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, Catherine, I wish we'd have had Charlie on before the election. Jason Carter could have run a whole different campaign. He could have run from the right. He could have said, Nathan Deal, soft on crime and bringing Hollywood values to Georgia. The Republicans might have voted for us instead. You know,
honestly, that would have been more specific than basically saying spend more money on education without saying how it was going to be spent or where the money was going to come from. You know, honestly, that was part of the problem I saw with that campaign, is that he had, you know, a nice first shot, but I just never saw where it went beyond that. And, you know, at the end of the day, he took a message where he, again, at one point was ahead in the polls, but really allowed that entire race to get into a right track, wrong track question. And despite there being some high unemployment numbers that are still perplexing to some, I think the average Georgian really, you know, Nathan was able to say, this is my record, this is what we're doing, and this is the direction Georgia's going in. And I think at the end of the day, the incumbent governor was able to make a compelling case, while things might not be as good as we'd like, given where we were 4 and 6 years ago, we're actually better off.
Yeah, and I do think there's a nationalization of politics that has happened so rapidly. And if your city council does something, then a lot of folks are going to blame the party in the White House. I mean, it's just everything's looked at as a national.
Yeah, somewhere along the way, I wrote a column called All Politics Isn't Local, and it is exactly that. That's one of the reasons why we at Peach Pundit spend the time we do only on state and local, and we really just don't do a lot of the national issue of the day kind of topics unless it's through the prism of how it affects Georgia or Georgians in D.C. But, you know, if we can't make it a specific Georgia tie other than to say this will affect Georgians and then really just spend the whole time debating the national stuff, we're just playing into that game, because so many people that follow politics now, and depending on where you get your news, be it talk radio or MSNBC or Fox News, everything is this just ridiculous talking points that seem to come out of K Street PR firms for both parties of here's our talking points of the day, now everyone's talking about it, and people just are really shouting at what they heard 10 minutes ago at each other, and no one's really focused on all the things that happen at the state level and the city council level that actually affect every day where they live, how they live. And instead, it's all because we either love the president or hate the president, that's our politics and that's our level of quote-unquote civic engagement.
Yes. Well, let's continue, and that's what we do here. We like the southern politics. We'll talk about some national stuff, but we feel there's a lot of that. So I think we share that same vision with Peach Pundit, Catherine, and Blog for Democracy. I mean, the same kind of concepts. Well, let me bring another Georgia topic in. We've discussed this at times. We've had, you know, former sports editor Mike Kearney from the AJC come on in and other things. But you're a Cobb County resident. Two of the major sports teams in Atlanta, the Falcons and Braves, are going to get new stadiums in the next few years. I think a lot of people would argue that both their current stadiums are perfectly fine, and they kind of want new stadiums for different reasons. Falcons to attract, you know, big events, SEC championships, national championships, WrestleMania, Super Bowls, and also to line Arthur Blank's pockets. And then in the case of the Braves, initially when they moved from downtown to the proposed, or the, actually I guess the site they're actually pushing dirt around, just outside the perimeter near Cumberland Mall, it looked like it was just, hey, our people that go to our games are more likely to live out there, and it's we want to, you know, meet our demographics, if you will. And then the more you heard about it, they're going to plan all these shopping malls and maybe some residential area, and it's like they want to create their own little town, but with a lot of shopping next to Cumberland Mall, an existing mall in Cobb County. What's the view of all that from a Cobb County resident with the new Braves Stadium?
I'll stipulate it the record. I'm going to sound like probably the world's biggest hypocrite when I give you the answer, because I was one of the bigger opponents of the stadium deal for the Georgia Dome to be torn down so an equal but maybe slightly better Georgia Dome can be built next door. The Braves Stadium came about a little differently, and probably in, from an economic development standpoint, you know, the Braves play, I believe it's 81 game home games per year, plus any playoffs, plus one or two, usually preseason or whatever you call it, right, where they do an exhibition game or two. So you do have a lot more activity at a baseball stadium than you have at a football stadium year-round. And what that ultimately changes is the business model, though, for baseball is very different. Football really is the national pastime. That's what I have it on my TV right now across the room, and somehow Tony Romo is pretending to get good again. But people just – the baseball is a slow-moving game that, frankly, is the fan age is skewing up rapidly. It's no longer really America's pastime. And so the whole point of building out a entertainment destination rather than just a stadium really is where the baseball owners apparently have decided that's the future of being able to get fans to their games, and the infamous butts in seats argument. And so it's not – I don't think it's so much shopping that they're putting – around the stadium as additional restaurants and other what I would call nightlife around the stadium. And they want it to be a 365 day a year development, a destination, a place where you just normally associate, this is where we go out for the evening to have fun. And some nights there'll be a baseball game there. Other nights you'll just go to these same restaurants and hang out. But for the Braves and other baseball the prototype for this is just open, I believe it's Kansas City or St. Louis. I remember watching a game, and they were kind of talking about the comparison to that to several other stadiums that are going to be built. But I think at the end of the day, that's really the problem of why this is not downtown and is out in the suburbs, and it actually just happens to be about a mile and a half from my house where I'm standing right now. It's where they felt like comfortably they could create something that would happen. And the history of these kinds of developments in downtown Atlanta has been that the tourists kind of visit, but the locals don't. And you can put whatever dispersion you want on that, but that's just, I mean, we just saw this weekend, Underground Atlanta has finally been sold again after the third time to try to revive it, and it's been a failure. And this time it's been sold because someone's going to build apartments and other, again, 360 year-round to try to anchor that, not so much as a tourist destination, but just use the facility there to really kind of leverage off it being downtown, part of Georgia State University and right next to the Capitol, to try to land people and anchor people downtown that live there. So Underground Atlanta is now really going to be more of a residential play than it is to be get the tourists to come in and do an entertainment district there, because it's the history of Atlanta has just been it's been hard to get that downtown. And so when you started looking at the Braves putting a 20 to 30 year commitment and several hundred million dollars of their own money in addition to whatever they could get out of incentives for a corporation that frankly is based in Denver, Colorado, and really doesn't care that much about the product they're putting on the field as best we can see right now, their long range plan from numbers and senses, it's a lot safer to invest this in a relatively stable suburb that already kind of has this anchored, as you said, just, I mean, literally down the street at Cumberland Mall, where there's another restaurant district and entertainment district, and kind of buttress that with what they're investing in. And so the answer to your actual question is most people in Cobb County, I actually hear, are okay with it. There are the the groups that are perpetually against everything that made some noise. But frankly, the business community is in Cobb is very well honed and focused, and they made sure at every public meeting and public hearing that they had that they had just as many people holding signs say we support the Braves as the usual people that travel all around North Georgia being against anything that comes up. And so frankly, while it made a lot of news of the public votes, and I really think a little bit longer of a public hearing would have fleshed out some of the problems that we could have dealt with now that we're going to be dealing with over the next couple of years, we could have done before we signed the papers. You know, at the end of the day, once we solve the parking problem that's going to be there, I think most people in Cobb County are going to be quite happy with it.
Well, I know traffic is a major concern. They're saying that's already a traffic area, and they're thinking on game days it'll just be that much worse. And then I do have to wonder how effective that will be as this tourist destination, or not even tourist, but just it seems like everything there's park. They'll probably charge more for parking than they would elsewhere. The rent may be higher at the places, therefore the prices may be higher. It just seems like it's not going to – it may be fine on baseball days, but on the non-baseball days, I just don't know that you can artificially create a Wrigleyville, if you will, in Chicago. I think that was a stadium that's been around since 1911 or something, and everything built up around it. So I do wonder how this other component's even going to work, if it's just some concept that really hadn't happened. Because, like, I mean, you mentioned St. Louis, but that stadium is kind of right next to where Busch Stadium was, and it's where the existing St. Louis stuff was, if you will.
As far as being, successful or not, I would actually argue almost the other, given that they are going to be going in an area where there already are restaurants and things to do. If the prices are higher and it's more of an artificial experience, such as when you go into a sport venue and you all of a sudden are paying $7 to $8 for a beer, where you could go to a dive bar down the street and be paying $2.50 to $3 for a beer, you're already going to have that option there. And so I think, frankly, for these things to be successful, if they're, the rent is ridiculously high, and I don't know why it should be given the amount of public subsidy that's going in to the space of waiver or property taxes, then no, I don't think it would be successful. But, they're going to have to compete against other businesses that are already there and others that are moving in. So, whether I go to the Taco Mac that just opened up kind of across the street from Cumberland, or I go to whatever sports bar place it is in Bravesville, that's really going to be a market-based decision. The only real concern I've got at this point is that the Braves don't have enough parking spaces. The original parking plan that they submitted pretty much said they would be using the parking lots at Cumberland and the Galleria office complex and others that because they wouldn't be used at night. And almost every major landlord in the area said, no, you're not going to do that. We need our parking spaces for our existing customers. And so the Braves in the last week have bought Genuine Parts, which is a Fortune 500 company whose headquarters was directly across the street from, in fact, it was on, I think, the same side of the street as the Braves Stadium adjacent to it. They were on a 10-acre campus, and the Braves announced this week that they have acquired that 10 acres. Genuine Parts is moving about a mile down the road into a suburban office park called Wildwood. So they're staying in the neighborhood. But it looks like the Braves now have 10 additional acres that may or may not be turned into parking decks of some sort, because at the end of the day, they're going to have to control more parking spaces than they currently have. But outside of that, I think most folks in Cobb County are okay with the tax subsidy versus the perceived return on the investment, or are frankly glad to have something like that that puts Cobb County on the national map. And, it really, outside of the normal folks that tend to be upset about these things, it really went over a lot more smoothly than I would have expected, and frankly has a lot more public support than I might have suspected.
Yeah, hey guys, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead. That's
I have a question. How far is Cobb Energy Center from the new baseball stadium location?
Depending on how the bridges are constructed, it's not that far. I just don't know the linear way to walk there. But Cobb Energy Center is just down Acres Mill Road.
Yeah,
from
it's not
Cumberland
far.
Mall. And across the street from the Galleria complex, the Galleria is right on I-285. Cobb Parkway runs between Cumberland Mall and Galleria, and the stadium is kind of on the other side of I-285 from the Galleria building.
Right.
So if you were trying to go from one to the other, you would walk, you know, pretty much essentially through the, you know, from out of, you'd come out of the Cobb Gallery, or the Arts, whatever it's called, Cobb Energy Center, through the Galleria Office Park, and then across the famed bridge that is yet to be built, that I think is supposed to span I-285 and into the stadium, so it could be done. And I don't know that many people would go from one to the other, but possibly
well,
where you're leading with that question is that using the same parking at the same time for
well,
an event
no, I was
at
just
Cobb Galleria, sir?
I was just going to say that in Detroit, the Tiger Stadium is located close to sort of an entertainment district. And so what I was thinking while you guys were while we were talking about this is that I think in order to attract people on non-game days, you sort of have to have other things to offer them
mm-hmm.
besides just restaurants, you know. So
right.
I think if you had a way to get people easily from the restaurant complex at the stadium to, like, Cobb Energy Center for a concert, that I think that would work. I mean, I think, or if there was another venue, even a small venue like a Variety Playhouse sized place close by or within that complex, where you have, you know, concerts, and it doesn't even have to be named bands. I mean, people will go out for an evening if they can have some fun, see some music, go to a comedy show, whatever, have dinner. And especially if it's easy as far as parking and transportation. And, you know, I'm not crazy about this whole idea, but it's going to happen. So, you know, I sort of have to embrace it. There's traffic problems in that neighborhood, but not any worse than anywhere else.
That neighborhood is when I first got out of college, and I graduated late '89, 25 years ago now, and went to work January of '90 for a bank in Cobb County. Got very familiar with both the Cobb Chamber of Commerce and the Cobb Cumberland CID, Community Improvement District. The Community Improvement District is a self-taxing district of all the businesses around the Cumberland Galleria area. They add extra to their own property taxes to then put back infrastructure in that area. And what they've done over that 25-year period is to build a grid system that you have almost nowhere else that I'm aware of in Metro Atlanta. So while those of you that aren't from around here are very familiar with how bad I-75 and I-285 can be during the day, what you may miss is that a lot of these, there's a system of parallel roads designed all the way around Cumberland and Galleria that go out 3 and 4 levels that allow you to actually avoid getting on the freeway if you're going 2 to 3 to 4 miles in any direction, because you have all these circulator roads or whatever they're called, but it allows you to avoid the freeway system. And in much of Atlanta, you can't do that. The parts of Gwinnett that I'm most familiar with, it just seems like everything is designed to put you straight onto 85, and they wonder why you can't move up and down 85, and they added this toll lane so that if you really need to, you can pay $10 at rush hour to go one way up and down 85. And in Cumberland, Cobb area, you know, you don't have to get on I-75 or I-285 to get around this area where I live. You can get on Windy Ridge Parkway, or you can get on Cumberland Parkway, or the various roads like that that, you know, allow you to move and mingle in. You know, the question is once the Braves Stadium is built, which is on, you know, kind of the intersection of two of these grid roads that are just off of there, does that just gum everything up? And, you know, I'll admit I've got concerns of what it'll be like on game day, but for everyone that lives in town that's talking about the traffic, I can also tell you what the downtown connector is like if that's what you're trying to use at rush hour to get down to Braves Stadium. I mean, it's equally gridlocked. So there's not necessarily a good answer to the traffic problem, which is a whole separate question that I'm working on in my day job. But at the end of the day, that's the puzzle that needs to be answered. And, you know, at the end of the day, I firmly expect, if not for the first season of the Braves, but probably shortly thereafter, you're probably at least going to have bus rapid transit running along Cobb Parkway, probably to downtown, probably as far north as Kennesaw University or maybe farther. But there probably will be a transit option at some point, specifically to get people out of Atlanta and to the stadium. I just find it hard to believe that that's not going to happen to help alleviate part of this traffic problem we're talking about.
There's so many different facets of this discussion. And, Charlie, I'll say this, if you want to compare how Cobb has managed the last 25 years of growth compared to Gwinnett, I think Cobb would win every case because Gwinnett seems to just be, you know, the model of, you know, not white flight, but I guess just people moving out and then people leave the southern part of Gwinnett and then move to the middle part and then move to the northern and now they're moving to the next county where that hadn't happened in Cobb, right where the Cobb Energy Center is, right at the county line.
Well,
still a lot of nice things going on.
They hadn't rushed
the rest of Bartow County or whatever.
Yeah, I really don't say that to be insulting to Gwinnett because I honestly don't know what they did. And I think in a lot of cases I can compare it more to a Fayette County where I grew up, which is the one county in the 10-county Atlanta Regional Commission area that doesn't have an interstate highway going through it. But at one point, probably more than 25 years ago, probably closer to 35 years ago, there was a plan briefly floated to put a similar to Georgia 400, but a limited access highway straight through the gut of Fayette County down to Griffin. And our folks basically immediately turned it down saying, no, if we do that, we're going to grow. And that's been the attitude of so many of the suburban counties around Atlanta that they fought growth the whole time while growth eventually fought them. And Fayette County, when I was born, had 12,000 people in it. Now it's got about 110, 120. So in my lifetime, 45 years, it's gone up by, you know, a multiple of 10. Cobb County, on the other hand, I remember again, attending one of these chamber or CID meetings, I don't remember which, back in the very early 90s, I remember sitting through a presentation where they said, I think we have, I'd have to guess the number, but I think we were around 250 to 350,000 people then, saying we're going to have 700,000 people here in 20 years. What do we do to prepare for that? And that's where they were discussing things like that grid system, things like putting a road called the East-West Connector that kind of goes from through the southern gut of Cobb County and then turns north and links into Town Center Mall up in the north end of the county. And so they added new roads knowing people were going to come in, and instead of pretending like they weren't going to grow, therefore they should just avoid putting in infrastructure to stall growth, they realized if they didn't do it then, it would never happen. And that's really one of the large problems we have in the northern part of Atlanta and why we're going to have problems getting people, frankly, from Gwinnett over to see the Braves, is because you can still move north-south in Atlanta reasonably well during rush hour. Not always pretty, but you can at least have a defined path of how to do it. It's just almost impossible now to move east-west in large distances, especially in the northern suburbs of Atlanta, because there just aren't roads to do it. And you just don't have the right-of-way anywhere to even begin to try to solve the problem with anything new, roads and probably not new transit, short of totally rebuilding I-285, which the estimate on that across the northern end is right about $4 billion. So we pretty much have a traffic problem, and the Braves Stadium isn't going to solve that and hopefully doesn't make it worse.
Yeah, and you were mentioning the dome as well. I wouldn't for either project. Just because I thought they were perfectly fine. But now one thing I will say is it's not just 10 Falcon games. It's now 17-plus MLS games, and Georgia State plays there. By the time you have concerts, you know, they're going to get up to well over 81 events as well. So
I understand the need of keeping the dome or a dome as part of the World Congress Center. That is an event center of statewide, if not regional, importance. It's just a question of whether or not spending the taxpayer money from the hotel motel tax, which is a lot more than the $200 million headline that's always used. It's 0.37% of 7% of every hotel bill for the next 40 years in the city of Atlanta. And that's more than $200 million, but that's what goes to the Falcons as part of that deal. And so once those bonds are retired, it's the Falcons' money. They have to upkeep the stadium, so there's a cost to that. But, you know, it was a lot of money at a time where Atlanta now, as part of the transportation, is talking about having a $1 billion backlog for maintenance they haven't done on roads and bridges. They want to spend $700 million on a belt line. There are other projects that they want, including extensions of MARTA, not in that. It's not directly the city's responsibility. We have all these infrastructure problems, and instead we're going to spend $700 to $800 million of a guaranteed revenue stream to replace a stadium that is right next door to a stadium we already had. And if the incremental value is, you know, getting a Major League Soccer team, okay, that's okay. But I'm still not sure that's the best bang for the buck that the city could have gotten, but I don't live in the city, so ultimately that was their responsibility and their decision.
Well, and that was 17 games, but that was just an example of, I mean, you know, it's not
right.
81 versus 10. It's just to be fair, I'm trying to say, hey,
right.
I mean, there's
no, I
you know, rodeos.
That's what I'm saying. At the end of the day,
you don't
if you told me.
Stadium.
Yeah, and I say it's fair. I mean, again, I was against it, but I also, once I lose a battle, I don't try to keep fighting it. And so there's no reason. I mean, the stadium's being built. Will I go to Falcons games? Yes. I mean, I'm not, you know, one of these. I didn't think it was the right thing at the right time, but, you know, I unfortunately do not get to play benevolent dictator for the state of Georgia, the city of Atlanta. So I made my case. I lost. We move on, and, you know, I'll be glad to attend those events, although probably going to be difficult to get me to go to the soccer games. I still just don't get it as a fan. You know, it's not my thing, but to each his own.
Yeah, and I'll drive right past the Braves Stadium to go to a soccer game first. You know, and that's what I mean. And so it's just all will won't. And I actually have to deal with the North End perimeter going to Silverback games three times a year. But luckily it's on Saturday where it's not too dreadful. Well, let's kind of move on to something else. We've done real well, but let's talk national politics, but with a southern slant. And we'll get into this presidential race. Last week, Catherine, myself, Jeff Singer, we spoke about if Hillary Clinton could run against President Obama and how that would be. We thought that would be dicey, but we hashed that out. Now, Jeb Bush has officially entered the race, former governor of Florida. That's our southern hook, if you will.
Has he officially entered the race? Or he's officially entertaining running the race.
He's as official as you can be at this point. And,
right.
You know, it's legal games
account.
That everyone plays. But let's just go ahead and call him a candidate.
Okay.
Yeah, Karl Rove's following him. He's official enough for the Cubs' design. We have a low bar.
Okay.
But anyway, my question, Charlie, I'm going to let you talk about this first, but I also get Catherine's thoughts on it too, is can Jeb Bush run against George W. Bush, and how tricky is it? And to me, if he does it, it might not be, but on policy, like I disagree with my brother on this issue, it may be, in my own mother's words that people have gotten out, I'm the smart one. Charlie, can he do this? And if he did, how nuanced does he have to be? Or can he just not touch this?
Well, he almost has to. Whether he, you know, addresses it directly or indirectly, that's how this is going to be framed, especially while he's the only candidate. So when he's the only candidate, he is running against George. And if you remember when W ran the first time, he was somewhat having to run against his dad because his dad was a one-termer. So it can be done. It can be done successfully. You never underestimate the institutional advantage that he's going to have of being part of a network that elected not one but two presidents through the Republican nominating process. And a large part, while we all like to pretend that the primary is really where the people come in and speak, we all know that in both parties, it really has as much to do with party insiders that use whatever leverage they have towards the person that they want as it is about the people speaking. And that's not to say that the establishment, whatever that means, ultimately wins. Because in the Republican Party, the establishment is one of the most oxymoronic terms that you can imagine. I mean, you know, our establishment has long been eaten up with Tea Party folks, and before the Tea Party, it was eaten up with the conservatives / social conservatives. You know, the establishment is a little bit of everybody, and I always love, frankly, going to the state of Georgia GOP convention, where generally 75% to 90% of the people there are railing against the establishment, and you look around the room, it's like, how do you think you get here and you have titles within the party without being part of the establishment? And when you say that to them, it's like you just shot them. But, you know, the lack of self-awareness that if you have a leadership position in the party, you have the responsibility to be the establishment because you are by definition at that point is kind of funny. So I don't worry about Jeb or Mitt or, you know, whichever other quote-unquote establishment candidate versus some of the fresher faces. You know, it was President Obama that used the term that I believe we're going to hear a lot over the next 2 years called that new car smell. And it was one of the most strange gifts he gave to a burgeoning Hillary Clinton presidency because she's been around D.C. a lot longer than he has. So if he's saying that the voters want something that has a new car smell, it's hard to say that was a ringing endorsement of Hillary. But at the same point, it could apply to anyone named Bush or possibly anyone named Romney. And so in the Republican primary, to me, it's just really interesting because, you know, we could have as many this time as 10, 12 people running, and we could have as many as 8 or 9, what I would say, credible candidates. And the beauty is, and one of the reasons I'm actually glad Jeb is running, he's not afraid to articulate why he's running and has some ideas that are, frankly, out of lockstep with conventional wisdom of the party. There are others that will do the same thing. And so to have the kind of debate we had this morning on the Sunday shows between Rubio and Rand Paul, that's good and healthy for a party that says it's the party of ideas, but frankly hasn't really been demonstrating a lot of new ideas lately. I mean, most of our victories have been running against you guys, and that's often enough. Given, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, the approval rating of the president going into November. But at the end of the day, if Republicans are going to convince folks that we're about governing for the long term and not just winning elections every 2 years but losing them again 2 years later, we've got to convince voters that we have ideas about governing that are serious and that can be implemented, and that ultimately a majority of voters feel better off after we do that. And to do that, I think we really have to get a field that is large enough but credible enough to really hash that out, so that by the time we're mid-2016, the Republican voters and the Republican primary bloc have had a good chance to basically say, this is what it means to be a Republican now, because when you go to Republican meetings, there are some genuine disagreement of what it means to be a Republican.
Yeah, Catherine, now let me pose this question to you too. Do you think Jeb Bush can run against George W. Bush? And if he does, how does he do it?
I definitely think he can run against him. I think that, I mean, I hate to cast aspersions on former presidents, but I don't think that W. Bush has the, I mean, I don't think he's rated as one of the greatest presidents in our times. I don't think anybody, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think anybody would rate him as that, partly because of the things that happened under his watch that weren't necessarily his fault, but it just happened that he was president at the time. So, I mean, some of them people would say were his fault, but some people would not. But in any event, they did happen. So I think that it's probably easier for him to run against for Jeb to run against George W., because it wasn't the ideal presidency. So, plus, I don't know. I mean, I think that you have to always be forward thinking, but have some reflection on what happened before. So I think he can I think he's a smart guy. He can successfully, you know, still be welcome at the Thanksgiving table and run for president and run against his brother.
Yeah, and
it is tricky in the family thing.
Well, I might have missed some nuance in the question. So I'm first going to say I don't think he has to run against George Bush if you're saying it that way. I mean,
yeah, I don't think he has to.
While there were many issues within the Bush presidency in a Republican primary, you still got the comparison between Bush and President Obama, that at the end of the day, your Republican primary voter is, you know, there are a lot of folks still have bumper stickers or the signs go around that say, miss me yet, if you will. And so
it's no matter having
to run against him, and that's not the way I was trying to answer the question. Is he settled with that, and can he differentiate himself? And to be clear, I think he can, but I don't think he's necessarily running away, because he gets a tremendous advantage. You know, it's not just the Bush name, it's the Bush network. And so you can't run against that necessarily while tapping that network, but you can differentiate that there's a difference between Jeb, between W, and between HW as needed. But at this point, you know, I think the field's going to be crowded enough that gets him instant credibility and it gets him a network, but he's going to have to sell his ideas to a Republican primary base that's just very skeptical of anything and everything that looks like governing, and he's a guy that wants to try to govern. And so he's got to make the case that what Republican means is what he wants to run on, and he's got an uphill thing, but if he can win that, he's got a great general election message. He's just got to figure out how to win a primary with it.
Yeah, that would be my – if I was Jeb Bush, that would be my concern. Like, can he maintain his own personal credibility and desire to govern, like you said, and win a primary?
Yeah. All right. Well, while we're on this presidential race, particularly the GOP side, one more topic. Rand Paul, you know, people are saying he's angling at being that Tea Party candidate. Well, he's up for – Senate re-election. Well, we know a lot of states, it's no big deal. The Secretary of State, who's been in a little bit of the election news, Alison London Grimes, stated that Kentucky law's clear. I haven't read it right off the books, but I'm going to take her word for it. Says that you can't be on the ballot in two places for two offices. Charlie, what does Rand Paul do? Does he, you know, drop his Senate seat and go for it all with the presidential race? Does he somehow challenge this thing? Or does he decide that the Kentucky Senate seat is that valuable and just hold off?
I don't know him well enough, or frankly, the people around him. I should say I don't know him at all, and I don't know his people to know really what he does. But I think what most politicians do in this case, and if I'm not mistaken, I think the Kentucky legislature's are both Republican now after this last election. So if that becomes an issue, the first step always is to change the law to be what you want it to be. So if Grimes is saying the law is clear, well, you've got one or two sessions of the General Assembly up there to change it. So if not, then he's got, I believe Marco Rubio has the same issue. He's at least said he will not be on two ballots. Now, whether or not Florida law allows him to or not, but Rubio has said he's either going to run for president or run for reelection. And so you're going to have people kind of having to make that choice across the board. I think they're the two main ones at this point. I'm pretty sure most everyone else is term limited, or you will be nearing the end of a second term governorship or whatever. But, you know, it's a constant decision at this point. And I think that was a bigger deal 10 to 20 years ago than it is now. Folks are so used to seeing that as being part of national politics that I honestly see the ability of running for two offices at the same time is not that big of a deal. But I won't pretend to know state politics level in Kentucky well enough to know if it really is or not, especially given that we just had a competitive election over McConnell's seat. That if the wave is going differently 2 years from now, what local Republicans may want to have to decide is Rand open for a challenge from the left, from Democrats, and what that polling number looks like, and do they need someone that can focus running full-time to make sure that Senate seat stays in Republican hands rather than someone just assuming that and taking it for granted while taking a flyer at running for president?
Yeah, I agree with you. I personally don't think it's a big deal, and this can be, you know, a Democrat running, a Republican running. Catherine, the reason I find it interesting is it's Alison London Grimes chiming in on it. And if things go as planned and Jack Conway runs for governor of Kentucky, she stands down on that. Then if Rand Paul does make the move, I'm running for president, that's a vacated seat. She could have possibly had to rule or give her opinion in a seat that directly impacted her presidential career. Do you think this makes this a little juicier?
I guess. I don't know. I actually disagree with you guys. I don't like it when people run for two offices at the same time. I think, you know, make a decision. You know, I think it weakens one campaign. It's got to. You can't run for – I don't think you can legitimately run for two offices at one time. Give up one of them. Make some space for a new face or a – you know, someone who's been in state politics and it's time for them to rise up or something. I don't like it. I think it's greedy, and I don't like it. I think it's I want them to make a decision, make a commitment, decide.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate to get it.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
What happens
now,
if you win?
Y'all,
both of them.
Yeah, well, I'll say this. To me, it's like when you have a job and you want to seek a better job, Do you quit that job before you go out for the next job, or do you say, hey, I'm going to keep the job I got, and then I'm going to look for another one and then put my resignation in? It's kind of like Tarzan. You know, he would hold on to the one vine and reach for the other one before letting go. You know, and that's we kind of want that same security in our own lives, just in our regular stuff besides politics. Maybe politics is different.
I don't know. Politics is different.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, because other people are impacted. The example of a job is that, you know, you interview for a new job and you get it or you don't. It's usually a pretty quick process. You're not focusing all your energy on running for a new job. You're, you know, preparing your resume usually on your own time, submitting it, interviewing usually on your own time, and moving on. You're not, you know, spending all your time for 6 months or longer, a year for a president, a lot longer, focusing on this new career.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just a debate that we may end up having again as this thing unflushes itself, like Charlie brought up with Marco Rubio and Rand Paul. Well, Charlie, I sure appreciate you coming on during this holiday season. We know you're a big Falcon fan, and that's why you're able to come on since they were playing in New Orleans. We got to watch the big win, and you got to call in. But we sure do appreciate it. We kept you a little overtime because we're so glad to get you.
Well, I'll get time and a half for that, I'm sure.
Yeah, maybe
I get double
so.
Time for Sunday.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we will not deduct anybody's paycheck, and we'll triple your salary. I was on a radio station in Rome, Georgia, where they always told me they would do that, and it was volunteer work, so they always did.
Yeah.
Well, folks, we don't know exactly our schedule with the holiday season and the Falcons season, because we could be playing Sunday night football next week, and, of course, that affects me. But we'll kind of keep you posted on what the show will look like for next week or the next. But until then, it's been the Cubsy Vine.
Happy holidays, everybody. Good night.
See y'all later.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has...